Welcome to The Right Chamber, the podcast that takes you inside the NHS to explore what really makes a hospital a hospital.
Each episode, we sit down with the people who keep healthcare moving, from doctors, nurses on the front line, to students, the support teams, administrators, corporate staff, and everyone in between. These are the voices that often go unheard, but together they form the heartbeat of our hospitals.
Our aim is simple: to share authentic stories that are accessible to the public, meaningful to NHS staff, and a reminder that healthcare is more than treatments and wards. It's a whole community working together.
So whether you're part of the NHS family or simply curious about the people behind the service, join us as we open the doors to the conversations that matter here in the Right Chamber.
Dr. Richard Aleen, a palliative medicine consultant since 2014, primarily serves the community. Over the past 3 years, he's also been a well-being champion for resident doctors. His dedication in both roles earned him the prestigious Medical Directors Committed to Excellence Award in 2023.
Welcome back to The Right Chamber, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of healthcare and introduces you to the people and conversations that keep the NHS moving.
Today we're tackling a topic that many people will have heard about, but often don't fully understand: DNA CPR decisions. What do they actually mean? Are these conversations approached with patients and families the right way? Why they can be misunderstood?
To help us explore that, we're joined by Richard Aleen, who'll be sharing both professional and personal perspectives on DNA CPR discussions, including how they can be handled with compassion, clarity, and dignity.
And before we start, if you notice either of us sounding slightly delirious, we're recording this in our hospital office that's currently sitting at, 29 degrees Celsius during the heat wave.
That's right. In true NHS fashion, the cooling doesn't appear to be working, but somehow the radiators are still giving it their all.
So while we're trying not to spontaneously combust, let's get started.
Good to be back. Lovely to see you.
I know we've had you on previously, which we have talked, around the topics of palliative care, palliative medicine. What is palliation? What does that involved, talking about comfort for patients. Today we want to talk a little bit more specifically about the element of DNRs, do not resuscitate, which is quite a big, aspect of when we're talking about really unwell, particularly frail patients. And as doctors, we might have a different understanding of this, but from our listeners, we will have we will have listeners out in the community who perhaps their only experience of DNRs, it could be with loved ones, but it might also be from maybe media or things they've seen in the movies. So hopefully we can clarify some things today.
I think the first question would be, what is a DNA CPR?
What is a DNA CPR? Do not attempt DNA cardiopulmonary resuscitation. So it's a decision that's made. And it's a really important decision. And it can be a really challenging discussion or decision, both for patients, families, but also for us as doctors as well. Having those sort of conversations and making that decision, there's a lot of challenge around it. So it's a really good topic, I think, to bring up and to discuss. So what is a DNA CPR? So like I say, it's a decision that's made for patients who we make a medical decision about because we think that that patient doesn't have the physiological reserve. That's just a fancy way of saying sort of physically strong enough to be able to withstand or to tolerate that sort of intervention, the intervention being resuscitation and a resuscitation attempt and everything that goes along with that. I think sometimes the idea of resuscitation might be hugely oversimplified into, oh, well, it's almost like just giving a treatment, some compressions on the chest that's going to sort of restart the heart and is going to bring the patient back to how they are today, which is sort of alive and kicking and actually quite well. Whereas actually that's not the case. And so these decisions, when we make them, are actually well thought through and are made when we feel that that patient is not fit enough to have a resuscitation attempt made. Does that make sense?
I think it's where the media misconception is, where they see someone do like few pumps and then...
And a shock.
Yeah. And that's and it.
And then the patient... There's always that big gasp. And
the patient's alive. And then the next shot is them talking and doing completely well. But that's
and
not
it's in
the
movies,
reality.
It's in Casualty.
Yeah.
It's in ER. What else? Grey's Anatomy. All of those sorts of things where you see that happen. I mean, to be fair, I think we need to just distinguish between... So if you've got a patient who's actually relatively fit and well and they have a cardiac arrest, they go into what's called an arrhythmia and they collapse. You know, it's entirely appropriate to attempt resuscitation on a patient like that, for example. But what we're really talking about today are those patients who have got life-limiting conditions. It might be that they've got a cancer, it might be that they have renal failure, some end-stage respiratory disease or heart failure, those sorts of almost palliative diagnoses could be frailty as well. And that we know that they're coming to the end of their life. It's for those patients really that we're talking into today or talking about today.
I think it's important to mention that age is not the limiting factor.
No, that's right.
It could be a younger person with different comorbidities or limiting factors, or
absolutely
a healthy 80-year-old.
Absolutely.
Where we would choose to resuscitate them.
Yeah, that's right. My father-in-law is about to turn 80. He looks like he's 60. He would be very distressed if I turned around and said, oh, I don't think we should resuscitate you. Yeah, he's certainly not, even though he's about to turn 80, he's not in the frailty bracket at all. However, I've seen plenty of patients who are in their 70s who are frail and who have frailty syndrome. So, you know, it's like you say, it's not an age thing. Age might make you think, start to question it, but it's not an age thing. That's right.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, it is a decision that is being made, and you say it's a medical decision that's being made. Now, this is a very, you know, it's not a simple, straightforward decision. There's lots of things to be taken into consideration. And I suppose the other aspect of that is how much of this medical decision do we involve the patient in that decision making? You know, I guess you can think of it as perhaps some other areas of medicine. If you want to prescribe something perhaps to the patient, you would ask them, how do you feel about this medication? This is why I would offer it to you. There's another, maybe this other alternative. You know, part of medicine is want to keep the patient involved and at the front of that decision making. But then this specific aspect and this specific decision, to what degree is it, this is what's happening, or actually let's have a discussion?
Yeah, I think that's right. So like in terms of it being a treatment, it's a significant treatment. And so when we're making decisions about resuscitation attempts, it's not to do with whether you want it or not. It's whether or not we believe that medically it's going to be successful or not. And I think that is the key.
What is a successful CPR?
Resuscitation attempt.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good question as well. So going back to sort of my scenario of a 40-year-old who has a sort of cardiac arrest out of the blue, getting the heart to restart again and the patient to leave hospital successfully and with a good quality of life, that might be counted as a success. In the patient population we're talking about now, so those with multiple comorbidities or progressive disease or cancer that's getting worse, in those patients, just trying to restart a heart which has naturally come to a stop, I would not see that as a success. And the reason for that is because we're talking about quality of life. And actually, when someone's heart naturally stops because they've become that poorly, they've become that unwell, their physiology, that the way their body works has deteriorated so far that their heart has literally naturally stopped, then having a drug that just gets the heart beating again isn't going to reverse everything else that's going on for that patient. And in fact, it's probably going to make them worse.
I think it's putting it out there that once the heart stops, all your other organs are not working either. Mm. And it's that time between everything stopping as well, especially the brain.
Yeah.
And once you start the heart and the brain starts getting oxygen, sometimes it's too late.
Most of the time
or it's too
late. In fact, almost all of the time, yeah.
And that affects the quality of life the most.
I think one of the things with maybe the way that people perceive resuscitation is that if you restart my heart, I'm going to be up and about and feeling well back to normal. Mm-hmm. But that's just not the case.
You know, we have to show a bit of grace to, you know, say family members who might have this image, you know, coming into hospital of, oh, if they perform this medical intervention, it would, you know, somehow bring them back to where they were in terms of how active, maybe speaking and to the same level of activity. So we have to approach that conversation in very carefully, isn't it? To make sure that we actually give them the education and that we can, in a gentle way, such that they understand that physiological reserve does matter.
And it's not that we're just giving up on them or withholding a treatment for them that they deserve or something like that. These are all things that people have said to me. Why are you giving up on my mum? Mm. Or you're not letting her have this treatment. Why can't you let her have this treatment? It's a much more complicated decision than that.
It's a sensitive topic. But
it's really sensitive.
How do we approach it? What's a good way to start this conversation with a family member? Or the patient, or both.
Yeah. I mean, so can I say what you shouldn't do, first of all?
Yes.
Because you said, how should you approach it? Can I say how we shouldn't approach it? The last thing you should do is say to the patient, do you want to be resuscitated? And I feel very strongly about this, that if you say to a patient, do you want to be resuscitated? You're giving them an impossible, unanswerable question, because like lots of people might say, no, I've had enough. And we do get that, right? But actually, if you're asking that person, do you want to be resuscitated, when you as the doctor know that they don't have that physiological reserve to survive successfully a resuscitation attempt, then what kind
it's
of choice
unfair
are you?
Question.
It's an unfair it's, question. Yeah, that's right.
It's giving them hope that you're asking me this question. That means it might be successful.
Yeah, it's a loaded question, which is setting up the patient to fail. It really is, because then if they say yes, like how are you going to, I can imagine people saying, well, yeah, I mean, if you're going to give me the choice and it's going to work, then yeah, I'll have it. I'll have a bit of resuscitation. Yeah, give it a go. Let's see what happens.
So what is a good way?
So there's probably a couple of approaches depending on who we're talking to and what their issues are around resuscitation. When I say their issues, I mean like, some patients feel very passionately about it, and some relatives in particular can feel very strongly that they want their loved one to have a resuscitation attempt because they've got a very fixed picture. So I might approach that, and I'll talk about that in a moment, but I might approach that differently to someone else. So the way that I tend to approach this is using something that I call the turnaround, which is really not asking the patient about resuscitation at all. And I take it from a completely different angle, which is talking to that patient or the family about things such as, how have you been? How have things been changing for you over the last few months or the last few weeks? What's important to you as you've been getting more and well. I'm asking them, where is it that you want to be looked after? Often they'll say, I want to be at home. Okay. And is there anything you're worried about happening when you're at home? And it, often things like, well, I'm worried about being in pain, that my wife's not going to cope, that we're not going to know what to do. Now, these are all questions that we can answer and give support to, or we can support your wife, or these are the phone numbers. This is the care that's available at home. This is the support that's there. Often patients just don't realize what's available in the community setting to be able to support them. So actually, if we find out that that's their priority, that they want to be at home, that they want to have their loved ones with them, that they want to be out of pain, they want to be supported, they want to have carers if needed, they want to have good symptom control, all of these things. If we realize and sort of recognize that these are the things that are their priorities, then we can support them. Now, by implication, they're sort of indirectly telling me that they don't want to be in hospital, which means indirectly, they're also telling me that they don't want someone to swoop in and start doing chest compressions because they're inevitably going to end up in hospital. They just don't know that yet.
That is a great way to do it because, you know, and then it basically puts the patient at the forefront of the discussion, their values, what they want, that privileged part of, you know, the for us to be in that position, it is a privilege to care for them in those times. So giving the power to the patient to allow them to then tell us where they want to be, what kind of treatment, to be reassured that they will be supported, going from that angle rather than straight to,
do you want to be resuscitated?
Do you want to be resuscitated? It's such a, it's a different way of approaching it, whereas the answer then answers itself through discussion.
That's right, that's right.
Do you have any personal experiences about this from like a family member perspective?
Yeah, so my own, my mum died during COVID. She had a malignancy. She had a uterine cancer. And she died over, from diagnosis to when she died was 3 years, I think it was. And I remember the palliative care team coming in and having this discussion with my mum. And it was so important for our family personally, you know, because, you know, I didn't want to really have the conversation with my mum. I would have done if I needed to, but it was so good them coming in and sort of taking that responsibility off me. And I think what it achieved for us was that my mum, you know, she died at home and was looked after really well at home. And we were all around her. She had her symptom issues, but she died, I would say, peacefully at home. And if that discussion hadn't been had when it was done, I can see it sort of the tension building up, and you know, if nobody's discussed it and she's getting into a really sort of right at the end of her life and now someone's trying to discuss it, I can imagine that would have been quite distressing. But it was done in a very timely way where she was able to be involved in the discussion. She understood that she was deteriorating and declining, and I think, it like I said earlier, it achieved that peaceful death at home because we all knew what to expect. And so the conversation wasn't just about signing the form, it was bringing all of us as a family onto the same page so that we knew what to expect going forwards.
And I think the important part here is you got to spend time with her.
Yeah, that's right.
Because a lot of the times with...
And not worrying about it, not being like, are we going to do, we need to admit her to hospital? It's because it had been so explained to us in a really clear way. It was like, we all knew this was coming and we were all on the same page. It wasn't like me and my sisters were sort of having secret discussions in the next room about, do we need to admit mom and so
you were prepared.
On. We were prepared.
The whole family was prepared.
And that, and I think that prepared. I think when the palliative care doctor came in and had that discussion with us at home, like it brought everything out into the open and it just brought us, like I say, all onto the same page. And we were, and so then it was sort of like we knew what to expect and there was no sort of ambiguity about what mom wanted or about what we were expecting. So we were all on the same page. And that was really helpful.
So the timing of that discussion is so key.
There's not a precise right time, but I think we need to look for the signs of when to have it. So I think, like I've already said, it's when we as doctors recognize that there's a physiological sort of decline and no very poor reserve. And we think, it's our medical opinion, that an attempt to restart the heart is going to be unsuccessful. So that's the language. When we recognize that, that is probably the right time to have the conversation. But within that, you've then got to get your sort of the actual timing correct. So not necessarily when they've just walked in. Maybe not when they're by themselves, the patient. Maybe it's asking the family to come in to support. I mean, I'm talking about in an ideal situation here, because sometimes these decisions have to be made very quickly because the patient's deteriorating very quickly, or they're acutely unwell or something like that. So, you know, it is very much depends on the scenario. But I do think that the important thing is that we don't sort of hide away from having the discussion and wait for somebody else to have it.
Yeah,
I think we need to be proactive in our sensitivity, but proactive in initiating the conversations.
Because if you do, you know, shy away and leave it, you're ultimately boxing yourself more and more into where that decision may then need to be made in quite a hasty
decision
way.
Yeah.
Whereas if it had been done at a time where, you know, the setting was right, the family members are there, and you feel this is a conversation that is relevant now, then it would make such a difference to, you know, when someone's acutely unwell in ED or even on the ward, and the decision, there is no discussion in the notes anywhere about it, and now you're having to be in this tough spot.
And it's probably worth saying about who we need to involve as well. So I think, you know, that it's always important to involve the patient. There's one caveat to that. Do you know what that is? Just testing you now.
Putting us on the spot.
The one caveat to it is it came out of something called the Tracy case, which was back in 2014, I'm going to guess. Please look that up. But it was a case where a decision was made about resuscitation that didn't involve the patient. And I think the family saw it in the notes and were very upset, of course, that the patient hadn't been involved in the discussion. And essentially, this went to the courts. And I think the real problem had been that the patient had said that I want to be informed about all decisions about me. So when a decision like that was made without involving them, it was felt that it was breaching her human rights. And so the clarification that came out of that case was that we always have to involve the patients unless it's deemed that it's going to cause harm to the patient.
So what I'm hearing is the main purpose of all these conversations with the patient involved or not involved is their quality of life. What's going to be the end? Their quality of life needs to be
the main
important decision.
And it's different. It's different for everyone. It's all individualized decision making. Yeah, it's for that, for what's right for that person. So and I think actually conversations done well, and they might take a bit more time if they're done well, but I'll tell you what, it's going to save a lot of time on the other end, a lot of time and a lot of distress. So if we can bring patients and families onto the same page and understanding how poorly they are and that they're deteriorating, and actually a resuscitation attempt would be the wrong thing for them, that's essentially what we're trying to do. And like I said, I think I said it at the beginning, when I go in to have one of these conversations, it's not about patient choice, it's about communicating a medical decision. That's essentially what we're doing. We're saying, look, here's my medical opinion. We've weighed it up, and this is the reason why we don't think resuscitation is going to be right for you. But it's communicating that.
I'm sure our listeners, both clinical staff who are on the front lines of, you know, making these decisions, as well as patients and families who might be listening. I'm sure so many people have, gathered new knowledge about how this process works, and also, hearing from the doctor's perspective. And thank you for sharing your personal experience as well. I'm sure so many people will be receiving benefit as a result of this. So I think, a big takeaway from this is that these discussions need to happen in a timely manner, and that there are ways that we can communicate this medical decision to our patients while involving them, but understanding that it is the medical decision, but it can be approached in a way that is more positive than just withdrawal of treatment. So thank you so much for your knowledge and experience that you're always sharing with us. We do appreciate you.
No problem. Thank you for having me
on the podcast.
It's been a joy.
Thank you again. And for those listening, do interact with the videos. If there's questions that you have or something that you're unsure of, do engage with us. Put in the comments or send in an email to us. It's all going to be linked in the description. So thank you for staying with us. Thank you for listening. And
we'll see you next time.
Podcast there.
Remember to stay connected with us on social media. Follow us on Instagram and TikTok at RGUCMS. And subscribe to our YouTube channel, RGUC Media, for more exclusive content and updates. Thanks for tuning in to the Right Chamber podcast. Until next time.